I'm ready to go, so we're not going to be talking so much specifically about climate change today. Actually, there will be a little bit of climate change content, but some people have asked me to remind of the book that I was recommending earlier regarding climate change, and some of the records of teaching staff's requests to stock books in the bookstore got lost. So it's not stocked in the bookstore here, but you can get it through a bunch of means outside of the village. And that is called Storms of My Grandchildren by James Hansen, H-A-N-S-E-N. So he's a prominent climate change researcher. And in the beginning of that book, he kind of... He uses the terms, he is acting as a witness of climate change and has done the science and really feels compelled to come forward and try to get people to take action. And he contrasts that to another really prominent person named Stephen Schneider. And I've met these people both in person, and their personalities really fit these descriptions. Stephen Schneider is now deceased, but he was a preacher about this, and his personality fits the idea that he wants to be in the public eye and tell people what he thinks they should know. So that's more of his style. And he died about 2 years ago at, I'd say, 60-ish in age.
This was Hansen or Schneider?
Schneider is...
And how old is Hansen?
Hansen is about 70 years old now.
Okay.
He is still working as the director of the Goddard Institute for Space Sciences.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that's located right in Manhattan.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay, and... yeah, actually, I still have some printed handouts here in case anyone wants those. And I managed to recover a couple of those beach balls from the lost and found after people had kind of cast them off. So people are still welcome to take those. All right, the first part of my talk today is going to be more general information about my workplace. So we are the Great Lakes Environmental Research Lab. We're a office of National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, located just outside of Ann Arbor, Michigan. The logo in the center is our own local logo, and the one on the right is Department of Commerce, which is the parent of NOAA. And this is our mission, high-quality research, scientific leadership. And a lot of that leadership role is really organizing research along with universities in the area that will be mutually beneficial. And really outreach to groups like yourselves is another one of our missions. So we do research, leadership, long-term monitoring, technology development. We have a particular division that is working on that. Observation technologies, synthesis and assessment, outreach and education, like I'm doing right now. All right. We have facilities in Ann Arbor and also a field station in Muskegon, Michigan, right on Lake Michigan. Ann Arbor is not located right on any of the Great Lakes. Established in 1974, which is just a few years after NOAA was established. There are sort of two parent organizations of that. One was really a funded project called the International Field Year for Great Lakes, and that approached the questions from more of a biological aspects of the Great Lakes. And the other was a part of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, the Lake Survey. So that piece broke off of the Army Corps of Engineers and moved over to NOAA. I guess I didn't change the date on that. Our current budget is roughly $10 million. I didn't have the exact figure for that, and the number of employees is kind of approximate. SILR is an acronym for Cooperative Institute for Limnology and Ecosystems Research, and that's something that we have cooperatively with primarily the University of Michigan, but we can involve other universities in that as well. And that's a way to have collaborative research with the universities and also have university personnel housed in our building. And usually those are people who are especially hired for a particular project. And this is some of the description of what we have at our current building. And the current building was open right on New Year's of 2009. So we've got quite a new building. And maybe later on I'll complain about its location and the environmental sustainability of our location. But we have all of these facilities here. Yeah, and I'm sorry, I got here and realized I didn't have a picture of our current building. I had a picture of our old building prior to 2009. This is our Lake Michigan Field Station in Muskegon. The main building here was formerly the Coast Guard station in Muskegon, and the current Coast Guard station is just off the picture here to the left. That's a more modern facility, but our building is thoroughly renovated, so it's a pretty nice place. And this water right here is an artificial channel that carries the last several hundred yards of the Muskegon River into Lake Michigan, and what you see off to the right there is actually this is an area protected by a jetty, so it's a much less active bit of water, but this area is Lake Michigan itself. And here's another view just looking from inland along that channel of the Muskegon River and out into Lake Michigan. This is the main research vessel, the biggest one that we have. And being a climate modeler, I really don't do much field work or very often get out on these research vessels. But a lot of our biologists in particular are very active with taking actual samples of life out of the Great Lakes and investigating them. So they'll go out on these ships quite frequently, and it's kind of old, 1973, but it's newer than what it replaced, and it's partially owned by University of Michigan. You can see the logo on that stack, and the usual home port of the Laurentian is the Lake Michigan Field Station, but this summer it's been gone all summer to Alpena, Michigan on Lake Huron. It's 80 feet long, and I'm not sure whether I should say all, but most, and including the Laurentian, our vessels are powered by soybean oil. And the in addition to the fuel, the hydraulic fluids and the lubricants are all vegetable-based as well. And I just learned last week that another positive side effect of that, due to sort of the different kind of fumes that come out of it, is there's a lower incidence of seasickness on the ship. Yeah. So So now I'm going to talk about some of the research of a few of my colleagues, and Andrew Groenewald is one of our newer scientists, and he is dealing with hydrology of the Great Lakes, the quantity of water that's there. And I've discussed some things related to this already, but one of the things is this green outline here is the extent of the drainage basin of the Great Lakes. So any water that's draining off of the land within those boundaries is headed for the Great Lakes. And it's too small for you to see, but there are numbers on there indicating how much water for each lake is coming in from runoff from the land, how much is coming in as precipitation directly onto the lake, and how much is evaporating directly from the lake. And then there are pathways of connecting channels between the lakes, and the final outlet goes into the St. Lawrence River. So this is one of the things that Drew likes to point out. The amount of variability in levels of the Great Lakes, and comparing it to, I've illustrated here, is one particular gauge on the ocean at the Battery in New York, and that New York City gauge has a little bit of wiggle in it and just a small amount of trend to it, but the amount of variability is much less than on the Great Lakes. So there's been quite a bit of, yeah.
When I used to live on the Lake Michigan shore, there was some concern a while back about the influence of the St. Lawrence Seaway on the amount of water. Has that kind of equilibrated itself so, you know, there isn't, it was sort of like people who lived on the, had all these beach houses thought, oh my gosh, we're going to be inundated. Let's sell our houses quick.
Wow.
But that was,
okay.
I think, the 50s.
Yeah, all right. I haven't even heard about those kind of concerns about lake level from the St. Lawrence Seaway. We're going to be talking about invasive species later on, and okay. That's another thing that the St. Lawrence Seaway has been implicated for. But the one of the phenomena is the last almost decade and a half now has seen somewhat low levels. So if you look at the right end of the graph for Lake Superior on the top, that has fallen below sort of the red line, and Lake Erie is kind of at or below the red line, but Lake Michigan and Huron is especially below that line. And there's controversy about whether this is caused by climate change, but another thing that is brought up, especially because Lake Michigan and Huron is the one that's really low, is that there, yeah, let's actually back up to this illustration here. The water flows out from Lake Huron through the St. Clair River. There's one link that goes into this smaller lake called Lake St. Clair, and then another one that's the Detroit River that flows into Lake Erie. But there's a strong suspicion, especially promoted by this quite powerful Lakeshore Property Owners Association on Georgian Bay on the Canadian side. And they are making the claim that there's been either natural erosion or dredging, and I don't know if they think there's some sort of conspiracy to do this secret dredging of that river channel, but that has been proposed as a reason for this particularly low level of Lake Michigan and Huron. And we lump those together because it's not a river that connects those two. They really are one lake connected by the Straits of Mackinac, which is deep enough that they really maintain the same level. Yeah.
Is it possible that there's land subsidence in the area?
One of the things that people are always taking into account is glacial isostatic rebound.
Oh, coming the other way, rising up.
Well, the more northern parts of this region are rising relative to the southern part, and that causes a gradual trend in the tilt of the land, and that is rebound of the Earth's crust that's still left over from the last glaciation.
Question?
Yeah.
I see the fairly marked off level in Lake Michigan, Huron, and Lake Erie from 1860 to 1940-something, or late 30s. But it's not replicated by the graph for Lake Superior. Could that be attributed to the huge density population growth in the areas contiguous to Michigan, Huron, and Erie, and Lake Superior has a lot of less huge areas of population growth?
Yeah, I don't have all the details of this, but there are a number of possible things that are going on here. Yeah. There often are different differences in the climate regime between Lake Superior and Lakes Michigan, Huron, and the other lakes. And the level of Lake Superior really tends to be independent of the others, whereas there can be a backwater effect between Lake Erie and Michigan and Huron. Some other things that were going on, there have been different phases of dredging of the channels between, and the purpose of dredging is to allow freighters to go through.
Navigation.
Yeah. And also there have been different phases of construction of regulating facilities. So the ones that actually are regulated are Lake Superior has dams and baffles at its outflow that control the outflow from Lake Superior. Yeah. Michigan and Huron are not regulated at all.
Okay.
Lake Erie, we sort of say not really. People suspect that it is. But Lake Erie flows out over Niagara Falls. And one of the things that happens there is not so much that they're controlling the overall outflow, they're controlling at different times of day whether it flows right over the falls so people can look at it during the daytime, or whether it's shunted into the power plants that are there at night.
Interesting.
And Lake Ontario is very tightly regulated. There's a dam that's right there, and that has a power plant and locks for ships to go through and connect into the St. Lawrence Seaway. And this is just showing one of the inputs of these lake levels. It's showing that there's a positive correlation with precipitation. It's not entirely one-to-one, but generally a positive correlation. This is precipitation directly over the lakes. And then this is a comparison with evaporation directly over the lakes. So that's in the bars there. Yeah, and this is showing some bits of data that are based on older projections of changes in lake levels due to climate change. And this is actually some of the results that I was disputing in my talk yesterday, but nevertheless, he took some of this data and charted some typical variability based on some of these projections. And the point of this is kind of to show that there is enough variability that some of these results overlap with historical times. So now I'm going to talk about Great Lakes ice, and my colleague who is primarily responsible for this is Jia Wang. One of his major research results is charting downward trends in the amount of ice cover in the Great Lakes. So he's charted the individual lakes starting in 1973 up to 2011. And one of the things to note is that this does not include last winter, which was the very lowest ice cover on the Great Lakes in general. So the total for the Great Lakes shown at the bottom is a downward trend. And over 39 years, that adds up to a loss of two-thirds of the total ice cover. So these are the annual maximum ice covers that have been charted here. So that's a big loss in ice cover. And when you combine it with what I was talking about yesterday I was disputing some of the methods that have been used for projecting changes in evapotranspiration from the land portion of the basin. And I'm saying that those increases in evapotranspiration should not be expected to be as large as many have said in the past. But nevertheless, this loss in ice cover will lead to greater, if it continues, will lead to greater evaporation from the lake surfaces. And that's likely to add up to a net loss of overall water supply for the basin over the next few decades. But then one of the things to look at is that ice cover can't get less than zero. So eventually, this mechanism of greater evaporation due to ice loss is going to completely play itself out. And you'll no longer have that mechanism, and the evapotranspiration from land is likely to become more important. So consequences: greater winter evaporating area and duration. Another thing that might partially offset this is when you have evaporation, a lot of it from the lake, and especially during the winter, it can fall right again just on shore as lake effect precipitation. Usually we think of snow, but it can also be rain, and that might run right back into the lake. So it's really, given all those things happening, to the extent that they do, it's not a loss of water to the lake, but just a recycling. And energy loss to latent heat, the evaporation process is kind of self-limiting because you're going to be losing energy as a result of it. So actually, I'll pause for questions a little bit now if you have any. All right, this is another one of my colleagues, and if you look up workaholic in the dictionary, this is the picture you'll see. This is Hank Vanderplug. And he works with lower food web. He's a biologist. So this is a chart over time of the density of diaporia in Lake Michigan. And this is a native, very small crustacean, half a centimeter long. And it's one of the main, it was one of the main consumers of plant matter within within Lake Michigan and some of the other lakes, and was food for larger animals, and would propagate up the food web to the fish. And you can see 1994 and 95 on the left, it was very widespread throughout all depths of Lake Michigan. And 2000, it's been cut back somewhat, and by 2010, it's almost completely gone. And that's really poor resolution, sorry about that, but this is a picture of a cluster of zebra mussels on a rock. So each one of those is about the size of one of your fingernails, but they exist by the millions. They cover surfaces in the Great Lakes. So this is a history of their distribution. They were discovered right around 1990 and had colonized especially the northern part of Lake Michigan fairly soon after that. Became a little more established in 2000, but then they've died off too in more recent times.
So, yeah. About zebra mussel, as they were dying off, having spent all my life in Minnesota except for the last year, Minnesota was very active in DNR and trying to get boats to be sure they're not bringing zebra mussels into the local waters of the state. So are they moving from Lake Michigan to local waters in different states? Or do you
Lake
know anything
Mead.
About the population of the local waters and states?
Lake Mead.
Yeah, they've
Colorado River.
They've spread to all sorts of lakes.
Zebra mussel now.
So they leave the Great Lakes, they go to the local.
Why the die-off?
Well, that's coming up. That's the next couple of slides. So who's ever heard of quagga mussels?
Yes.
You have heard of quagga mussels. They're a close relative. It's, this again is a poor resolution picture, but the upper row are quagga mussels and the lower row are zebra mussels. They're in the same genus. Quagga is Dreissena bugensis, and zebra mussels are Dreissena polymorpha. And they're close relatives, and they both got into the Great Lakes via ballast tanks. And apparently, zebra mussels first, and then quaggas later. So here's the time distribution of quagga mussels.
Oh, my goodness.
Ooh. Look at that. Outcompeted the zebra mussel for the source of food.
Yep. Yeah, they feed pretty much the same way. They're filter feeders, and if there's any plant material just floating around in the water, they suck it into their filter and derive the nutrients out of it.
Are either one edible?
I think you can actually eat them, but it's a lot of work to get them out of the shell for not much payoff because they're really small.
Okay.
Each individual is very small and has a shell.
Does the density in the upper right-hand corner in the year 2000 indicate the source was shipping through the Great Lakes, for instance? That's a Huron connection.
No, I don't think the density really indicates the source that much. They feed the same way as zebra mussels, but the quagga mussels are more flexible about their habitat. Mm-hmm. Zebra mussels really like to attach to hard objects, rocks and piers, that sort of thing. Quaggas are better at just living on sand, and also are prone to live deeper. So sometimes in really shallow water, the zebras are out-competing the quagga mussels, but by and large, the quagga mussels are taking over.
I assume this is coming up, but where to with this? Are they taking over all the habitats, fish and others?
They already have. There are some fish that have been able to eat mussels, but yeah, it's not very very efficient for them.
What is the mussel's natural eater, you know, on the food chain that consumes mussels?
Yeah, that's a good question. They originate from the Black Sea. So, yeah, I really don't know. There's a question over here.
How do you account for the fact that they seem to be driven out of Green Bay somewhat between 2005 and 2010?
Yeah, that's a good question. I wonder if that's actually a no data area.
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah, so they just didn't look
it's
at that, so it's not graphed.
It's a straight line.
Yeah. Yeah, and that would be sort of a signature of no data there. Oh, okay, this is, has part of it blanked out, so, yeah, here's the graph that we're looking at. One of the results of having these invasive mussels is what they're calling it, the old concept, the nearshore shunt, that's based more on zebra mussels than quagga mussels. And remember I said the zebra mussels like to live in shallow areas, so they're closer to shore. If there are plants growing there, the zebra mussels will pull them in and filter out the food that they want. And that makes the water very clear, so it looks good, but it's something that really does upset the food web and the circulation of phosphorus. So phosphorus is one of the nutrients that comes into the Great Lakes from rivers. So it's entering strongly from the edges of the lakes, but is strongly consumed near shore when these zebra mussels are there. So less of it is really propagating offshore. And then with the advent of quagga mussels, those are living a little more offshore, so the phosphorus can get offshore somewhat more, but it still doesn't make it to the really deep parts of the lake. All right, now I'm going to talk a little bit about work by, this is a colleague actually from a different building and different agency, Bo Linnell, whose real name is David, and he works in fisheries. So some of the particular events that have happened are increases in technology involved in harvesting fish. So yeah, this is a list of particular technologies. Some of the species that have been particularly overfished are, I don't even remember what species these are. I thought it was listed on here. I think that's a smelt at the bottom.
The bottom one looks like a whitefish.
I think it's a
whitefish. It has an adipose fin.
All right, then another thing is exotic species. Zebra mussels are up on the left, and quagga mussels aren't actually shown here. Another thing on the upper right is the big name is Bithotrephes. Common name is spiny water flea. And those are small things with big spines on them. Sea lamprey started invading in the 1930s, and the way that they got into the Great Lakes is not through ballast water, but they actually swam in through the Welland Canal via the Hudson and Mohawk rivers. And what they do, actually I'm wondering, I don't think that really is a picture of a, oh, these are the lamprey hanging off of this.
Right, it's a light trout with a lamprey on it.
Right. So yeah, they're blood sucking, very long, thin fish. Mm-hmm. And they are parasites on larger fish. Alewife is another invasive, and Chinook salmon was intentionally introduced, but took over a lot of the ecological niche of some other fish. Okay. There's been habitat degradation. One example is silt loading due to harvest of lumber. Construction of dams, contaminant and nutrient loading. So this is a lot of nutrient loading comes from fertilizers that are used for agriculture and lawns. And nowadays people are blaming lawn fertilizer for a lot of this because farmers are more careful about how much fertilizer they use due to economic concerns. Detergents also contain phosphorus, and contaminants often come from industrial processes. So a lot of these contaminants are what we would call point source pollution. That means they come from a particular industrial plant. And the nutrients tend more to be non-point source. They're fertilizers that are spread over very wide areas but wash into the rivers. Okay, so yeah, this is his outline. I pulled these from a much longer presentation. So management response to collapse, I guess, is the point we're at now. And a few things that have been tried with at least some success are sea lamprey control, stocking and harvest regulations. This is just sort of a set of graphs of how much of these different species have been stocked in the lakes. Lots of acronyms at the bottom. That's Fish and Wildlife Service, Great Lakes Fisheries Commission, Great Lakes Science Center, which is the employer of Bo Bunnell, who I got these slides from. And I think OMNR is Ontario Ministry of Natural Resources.
Well, the Chinook stocking was basically the result of a massive die-offs of alewives that was occurring after the invasion of the alewives, and the intent was introduce the Chinook to feed on the alewives because it's the primary size and source of food that Chinook fed on in here in the Pacific Northwest. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the thoughts in the process of introducing Pacific salmon into the Great Lakes.
All right.
I mean, there were massive die-offs of alewives along the shoreline in the Chicago area and on Lake Michigan, and dying by the millions. And so they introduced the Chinook as a means of trying to deal with this huge population of alewives that had invaded the Great Lakes.
All right. So, yeah. One of the things I was meaning to bring up with regard to the whole question of invasive species was another book you might be interested in. It has a really clever title regarding invasive species coming in through the St. Lawrence Seaway. It's called Pandora's Locks. By Jeff Alexander.
Like that.
Cool.
And yeah, he's been a long time newspaper reporter specializing in environmental issues.
Lox as in changing of levels, or lox as in Aunt Bagels? the series of lox.
Yeah.
Okay.
What about some of the other smaller fish species in the lakes? Are they surviving?
Yeah, well, I think the smelt has been reduced, and I saw a seminar a few years ago where they're saying it's just a whole new ecosystem with the with all the invasives that are in there, and it's really only the plant species that seem to be holdovers from prior to the invasives coming in. So yeah, you've got the alewives and the round gobies are kind of the smaller fish, and the salmon are the larger fish. I showed how the mussels have displaced the diaperia.
I think the sunfish and the yellow perch populations, particularly in Lake Erie, crashed.
The perch crashed too.
Yep.
With the advent of the zebra mussel and the Coaga mussel, there was not the food source available for them as juveniles.
Another apparent consequence of this nearshore shunt, where a lot of the phosphorus is trapped nearshore, and this is especially in western Lake Erie, is harmful algal blooms. So it's algae that release toxins.
The blue-green algaes.
Yeah.
What's been the effect on the other systems that feed off of the, you know, like I'm thinking of the eagles and fishing birds and maybe some of the animals further to the north that fish, maybe there's bear along Lake Superior, I don't know. What have they done?
Yeah, I don't really know about terrestrial animals that eat fish. That's really not a primary concern, I think, of the biologists that I work with. Because the Great Lakes are so large, it's more of an internal food web. I did see a bald eagle right on the shore of Lake Michigan last week.
Yeah. Alrighty then.
I think the population of the raptors, and particularly the bald eagles in the Midwest, have continued to increase significantly, and primarily due to the advent of the ban on DDT. But I know in the Midwest you see bald eagles now in areas where you didn't see them 30 years ago.
I think nationally that's the case.
Yes.
What do you predict? I mean, I know you're not supposed to, but what do you think will be the next stages of development of this process in the Great Lakes?
Well, one of the things that people are really worried about is the Asian carp. So that's something that's right on the doorstep of the Great Lakes, and I toured the place where they're really trying to block it. And that's an artificial part of the water cycle within the Great Lakes. It's actually covered by a treaty with Canada, and there's a limitation to the amount of water that can be withdrawn from Lake Michigan to go through. It's called the Chicago Sanitary and Navigation Canal. And the sanitary part of that is so that they can drain their sewage, treated, into this canal, and that's going to flow into the Chicago River, which eventually becomes becomes part of the Mississippi River, and that's as an alternative to putting it right into Lake Michigan just off their shore and drawing water right out of that again. So they opened that canal both for sanitary purposes and navigation to connect Lake Michigan with the whole Mississippi River system. And recently they put in this electrical barrier. This is the Corps of Engineers that did this. So it just puts an electrical charge in the water, and if it works, which it usually does, fish will swim up to it until they start feeling this electrical charge gradient, and that'll persuade them to turn around and go the other way.
Well, you're implying that the Mississippi River is already infested with the Asian carp.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. The whole system is really infested with Asian carp.
Well, turn them into a food source.
Yeah, well, that's people have talked about that, and apparently at the American Fisheries Society meeting, which happened a few weeks ago in Minneapolis, I got reports back that they had a Asian carp supper there.
Great. Couldn't happen to a nice bunch of folks.
Yeah. There's some compassion.
Yeah. Well, having been a bioengineer and president of the bioengineering section of the American Fisheries Society, I am aware of the actions that are underway, and it is frustrating. They're a very difficult animal to deal with.
Did you go to that conference and eat
some? I did not. I attended the conference in Seattle last year,
yeah.
And there were papers on Asian carp at that meeting as well. So.
Yeah, and I gather it's controversial, people guessing at how well they're going to be able to take hold, reproduce in the Great Lakes. Would you agree with that?
I'm very fearful, to be real honest with you. I'm somewhat pessimistic. They're probably already in with Michigan because they didn't get their electrification into the Chicago River system early enough. They are an incredibly aggressive. And supposedly all of these critters that were introduced into lakes to control the grass and along people's private property were supposed to have been triploid sterile fish. And unfortunately there were a lot of them that were not properly treated in terms of becoming triploids. And so you've got a spawning population of fish there now. And once they begin to grow, they do take over, and vegetation of any kind is going to be consumed.
Is there any natural predator for the?
Unfortunately, not. Mm-hmm.
People.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the things I've been told is they grow a whole lot bigger here than in Asia.
Yes, they do. Mm-hmm. Yeah, much bigger. Mm-hmm.
Maybe there's a new source for the lutefisk producers. That's why they have it in Minneapolis for the conference.
Well, now the salmon that go up and spawn in the Idaho and the California area, they provide nutrients to the water, which
yes.
is then used for irrigation, and so the farmers don't have to use much fertilizer. What about Asian carp as fertilizer?
Well, that's one of the things that they're certainly looking at is harvesting it and using it as a fertilizer.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks everyone for coming.
Thanks
for your input.
Yeah. All right.
What do the Asians do with the Asian carp? They eat them?
I think they do eat them, yes.
They do.
Yeah.
They're just real bony.
Yep.
What about the Guava mussels? Are they a food source for anyone?
Yeah, they're only slightly larger than a zebra mussel, and they're really awkward to eat.
They're significantly smaller than the mussels we get in the store.
Yeah.
But I like your line of thinking.
One of the things that I was observing on the lake level issues, the historic stuff, during the 30s, 40s, and 50s, two or three of the lakes in there was significant decline in, in lake levels, and I wonder if that was directly related to what is oftentimes referred to as the end of the Little Ice Age, the extreme cold cycle that we went through in that period of 30s, 40s, and 50s.
Yeah, well, one of my older colleagues who is now retired, he'd usually call that the Dust Bowl, and some people object to that because they'd say, no, that was really much further south, but it was a dry period in the Great Lakes Basin as well.
Because in the 40s and 50s, where I grew up in Montana, those periods of time, winter temperatures, and on over into the Dakotas and Minnesota and in that entire region in there, winter temperatures were extremely cold. And some of the ice data that I've seen recently, they do refer to that period of time as the end of the Little Ice Age.
I can't really make that connection.
Yeah. Time for lunch.
Thank you.
Yep. Thank you.
Thank you.